Hey, Amy.
Hey Jeff, how are you?
Good. Good to be talking with you again. We should introduce ourselves. I'm Jeff Charlotte, contributing editor for Harper's Magazine and author most recently of C Street, The Fundamentalist Threat to American Democracy.
And I am Amy Sullivan. I'm a contributing writer at Time Magazine and author of The Party Faithful about Democrats and religion. And that is actually the first topic we're going to get into today. I will put out there the qualifier for our audience that I just gave birth about 8 weeks ago, so I have not been following things perhaps as closely as I usually do, but this is a story that is close to my heart. I did notice with the midterm elections that Democrats made even larger losses among certain faith constituencies than they did just nationally with voters overall. One of the post-election debates that's been rising up in some progressive and Democratic Party circles is whether Democrats just completely gave up on faith outreach this election cycle as compared to what they did, particularly in the 2006 midterm cycle and 2008. And on the side of people arguing that Democrats didn't do enough are those who point out that the DNC has virtually no religion outreach anymore. For decades, they didn't have any, so this is maybe a return to status quo. But briefly, under the Howard Dean era, the DNC put together a faith outreach team, not just one person, as most of the constituencies have, but they had a whole team. Doing faith outreach to Catholics and to evangelicals, mainline Protestants. They've always had Jewish outreach and outreach to the black churches, but they really kind of broadened that reach, and that just simply doesn't exist anymore. There's nothing in the Democratic Party structure that's focused on reaching out to religious voters. The only thing that exists right now is the White House Faith Office. And they're not allowed to do political activity. There is something to the argument that any structure that had begun to form in 2006 and 2008 just simply wasn't in place this time. And so it's perhaps not surprising that in addition to losses overall in the midterm election, which everybody was expecting, that there were particularly large losses for Democrats among Catholic voters and among white Protestant voters generally.
Well, before we get to the losses, let's talk more about what happened. This was in place in 2008, not in place in 2010. I know you have been observing and reporting on this for a long time and have been an advocate for a certain approach. And so what happened to, for a while, I think there was folks that you saw doing good work there. What happened to them? Did they just disappear or why aren't they there anymore? Especially given the fact that you referred to the Howard Dean days, but now we've got Tim Kaine, former governor of Virginia, running the Democratic Party. This is hardly a guy who's allergic to either faith or to using faith as a political tool. Man who campaigned for governor, I remember there was ads that were, more or less, "Hi, I'm Tim Kaine. I read the Bible every day. You should vote for me." Where did he? Why did he veer away from that approach once he was in charge of the Democratic Party?
It really is surprising because it's hard to imagine that Howard Dean, who's the guy who said during the 2004 primary campaign that he left his church over a dispute over a bike path, he was the one who really embraced the importance, as he saw it, for Democrats to engage in
Well,
faith
it's a man
outreach.
obviously who feels his religious passion strongly.
Right.
He's a
And
schismatic,
yet, it's Tim Kaine who has kind of an ear for this and who did mention often when he was running in 2005 that he had spent time as a missionary in Central America, that his faith was important to him. He was somebody who made sure that that was a narrative that was woven into his campaign commercials. He kind of presided over this era in which Democrats kind of completely dropped their outreach. And again, as I say, that's not surprising for Democrats. For decades, they've just kind of left that ground to the Republican Party. And so that was one of the reasons after 2004 that a few people who are in the Democratic Party and who are people of faith and had connections with some of those constituencies decided that they needed to, in the phrase that my Time colleague Michael Duffy came up with, they needed to level the playing field and actually stop just ceding all of these voters to Republicans. There's been a lot of debate about whether that's an appropriate thing for Democrats to do, but I and others have made the argument that at least some of it is just kind of politics 101, that you don't give up to the other side a constituency like Catholics, for example, who make up almost a quarter of the electorate. That's a lot of people just decide that they're not going to be your voters, and there's not even any point in reaching out to them.
Let me jump in right there, actually, in a second, because that was something looking over the numbers, reading a piece in the Huffington Post that you had pointed me to, I think, by Eric Sapp, who's been a consultant on these issues. He said, compared to 2006, Democrats nationally saw a 14% drop in white Protestant support, 14-point drop with white evangelicals, and a whopping 20% decline with Catholics. To which I responded, what do you mean Catholic? You know, it's a quarter of the population, but those Catholics are also, they're white, they're Latino, they're Black, they're Asian. Some of them belong to unions. Some of them are in the Northeast. Some are in the West. I mean, how can we speak of that as a demographic? And is that possibly related to, I mean, what I'm wondering is, was the faith outreach in 2008 a little bit of, here was this huge wave that elects Obama, and there's some consultants there and saying, hey, you know, part of the way we did this is because we did this faith outreach to Catholics. Mm-hmm. And because the Democrats were happy at that point, no one stopped to say, what do you mean Catholics?
Right.
How can you actually do outreach to a group that is as hugely diverse as that?
Right. Well, you raise a very good point, and it's one of the reasons that I don't think you can use 2008 at all as an election that tells you anything about the so-called Catholic vote. As you point out, it's very diverse, and I think in 2008, perhaps as in this year, the overriding issue was the economy. So what drove Catholics was not, you know, their beliefs influencing their choice, it was economic issues. And in that way, they weren't very different from any other faith constituency. So 2008, I think you can't point to that and say, aha, this is the success of Democrats reaching out, or the failure of Republicans to connect with Catholics. What is striking to me, I think, is 2006, because that was a year in which the Democratic Party overall did not try to do any special outreach to Catholics. And so, in fact, their numbers bumped up a few percentage points nationally, but that wasn't really any different from their numbers bumping up among any other demographic groups in which they made gains. There were three states, Ohio, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, in which they really went in and organized among lay Catholics. And in some cases, you know, you had a state party chair in Michigan sitting down with religious leaders who had never had a Democrat come and ask to talk to them, and kind of just explaining their position, not saying, you know, we expect you to agree with us on everything, or, you know, you can't expect us to agree with you, just actually opening up a dialogue. And strikingly, in those states, Democrats statewide picked up 10 to 15 points among white evangelicals and white Catholics there. So there does seem to be some evidence that that inroads was rewarded in those states.
And that was in 2006, not 2008.
That was in 2006, absolutely.
2006.
Yeah. So that I think, is the more telling election to point to. 2008 doesn't really tell us much, except that the economy matters to people, whether they're Catholic or nothing.
I mean, I think about it in terms of, you know, so how do you appeal? So there's two ways maybe that you appeal to faith voters. One, you go and you meet with faith leaders. And that can be, you know, that's a little bit like reporters like to follow endorsements, even though political scientists know that endorsements don't actually make a big difference in elections. And I think that can be also, the importance of the person in the pulpit is sometimes overrated, especially, for instance, in the American Protestant tradition, either mainline or evangelical. which is built around you having an individual relationship with God. You respect your pastor, mm-hmm. but that doesn't mean that you necessarily vote the way your pastor does. And
exactly.
certainly that's true. And it's true in Catholic churches too. So outreach to leaders, that's kind of limited. The other approach is, of course, to talk about faith and values. And I think those terms should always come in scare quotes, because what do you mean faith? Faith isn't something you buy by the pound. We saw a couple of elections this year where faith and values really played a big part for Democrats. One a victory, the other a loss. One was Chris Coons and Delaware.
Right.
Christine O'Donnell has loomed so large that she has blanked out the name of the state for me. You know, where we saw this kind of comedic continual harping on, you know, was she a witch or not? And, mm-hmm. and you know, obviously she was trying to play herself as the Christian right candidate. But what really the result of that was Chris Coons is a person in the mainstream and Christine O'Donnell is in the religious fringe. And I argue that that's actually not accurate, that she was in the fringe, but that's another story. And then you saw in Kentucky, Conway versus Rand Paul, the Democrat there was really playing the religion card
right.
in a hard and nasty, nasty way.
Yeah.
Just the kind of way that Democrats have complained about Republicans doing, mm-hmm. you know, running ads of Buddha because Rand Paul had once had a kind of stupid interaction with something called an aqua Buddha, which wasn't a real Buddhist thing. And you know, talking about false idols. I mean, mm-hmm. when was the last time false idols was an election issue? You know,
right.
I think it was back around 20 BC. So, you know, the language was there and it didn't work. So the mm-hmm. two ways that you have of appealing, right? Talking to the leaders, that may never have been that big a deal, and talking about faith.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that that may not be a big deal too. So I'm just wondering, is it really true sure. that Democrats didn't do this outreach, and it maybe just didn't make a difference? I mean, again, you just go down the list. Brad Ellsworth in Indiana lost badly to former Senator Dan Coats,
mm-hmm.
A man who calls Dan Quayle his mentor. Brad Ellsworth is a guy who, you know, puts faith first and foremost, was a kind of conservative, faith-based Democrat, and he got trounced. And I'm wondering if really the case here is that when you try and do religion in the public square, when you try and use religion as a source of authority, well, folks who favor more authoritarian politics are always going to win.
Well, let me push back against you on a few different areas there. One is, just to take up Indiana. That was a state where I think faith outreach really did make a difference in 2008. You had people from the Obama campaign who spent the whole last month of the election in the state meeting people, going into Protestant churches, going into evangelical churches. And I think there is some effect of demystifying a group that's maybe then demonized, in this case, Democrats and liberals. And it is one of the reasons, I would argue, that Obama ended up winning Indiana, which was the state people didn't think that he was going to take in 2008, was some of that work. Because the gains, again, in Indiana in terms of white Catholics and white evangelicals in particular were larger than Obama saw nationwide that year. But just going back to 2006, I think that was the biggest reason to meet with religious leaders, is they would leave these meetings with the state party leader when no Democrat had ever even approached them to try to talk to them before. They thought, you know, there was demonizing going on both sides. And those leaders wouldn't necessarily go out and endorse Jennifer Granholm, but they also wouldn't preach against her from the pulpit. They wouldn't go tell people it was their Christian duty to vote against Jennifer Granholm. And sometimes that's all it takes to give somebody the leeway to go ahead and cross the aisle if they feel like they want to vote for Jennifer Granholm, and it doesn't make them a bad Christian to do so. I would argue
I think that's suggesting, look, a church that would, first of all, it's illegal to go in the pulpit and say, don't vote for Jennifer Granholm, right?
You don't
but
have to
of
do
course
it from
the preachers
pulpit
do
for it to be
we know,
clear.
Yeah,
yes.
We know what happens, yeah. right? But a church that has gone that far, you know, that is willing to say, that, where the preacher's saying that in the pulpit, where that's part of it, you're not going to that church if you're kind of on the fence.
You already
know where you're at. It's other churches where they're not talking about politics very often.
I don't know.
And those are mainline and evangelical churches where just the, you know, politics are not part of the meat and potatoes of the sermon. Those are the churches where you're going to get undecided voters. But I have a hard time, you know, imagining, you know, a very conservative megachurch pastor who's been screaming and breaking the law, screaming about Democrats for a long time. This time he sits it out and everyone says, hey, you know, I think I'll forget my convictions of the last 20 years and switch and go across the aisle.
Well, I'll just say I was a member of a Baptist church and happily a member where the pastor would say that you couldn't be a good Christian and be a Democrat. And that did influence good people in the church who otherwise, I think, would have been more likely to follow their consciences and just follow their own interests, maybe, in terms of how they were voting. But
that's exactly what I mean. A church with a pastor like that is filled with people who are going to be willing to consider other things. You know, you weren't going to, it sounds like, you know, from what I know, you grew up in sort of the old Southern Baptist. You're Southern Baptist, right?
It was American Baptist, actually.
Oh, American Baptist.
More moderate. Yeah.
And you know, as you know, even more liberal than the old Southern Baptist convention, which was liberal, but it was moderate. You know, that church is already filled with people. If you're in that church, if you're an American Baptist church as opposed to a Southern Baptist church, you've already made the choice to not entrench yourself in a certain kind of politics. Wonder how much really change is happening there.
Well, we're going to agree to disagree on that, but let me just move on to two quick other points. Yeah. One is in terms of the type of outreach, in addition to meeting with religious leaders, one of the things Democrats had done in 2006 and 2008 is just realize that there were issues where they could find some common ground with, to take one group, say white Catholics. The idea that professional Democrats had just written off that entire constituency for years because they thought abortion was the only issue that mattered to white Catholic voters was really short-sighted.
But that's just not true. What Democrats had written off Boston for years. I mean, white Catholics have other interests besides abortion and always have. And you know, the great shift of the Reagan years was white Catholics started voting for Republicans, but they were always a very natural Democratic constituency.
Well, in 1988, the Dukakis campaign made a decision not to have their candidate appear at any Catholic institution because they were concerned about protests over abortion. They were concerned that Dukakis would get questions about abortion. So that's a problem. The Kerry campaign made very similar decisions in 2004. Kerry was actually invited to speak at John Carroll University, a Catholic school in Ohio, which, as we know, turned out to be a key state in 2004. And the staff wouldn't let him speak there, and he was advised not to because they thought that he would get questions about abortion, and that would be it. What would have happened is that the local bishop who had agreed to appear on stage with Kerry would have been seen not endorsing Kerry, but at least, again, indicating that he wasn't a bad Catholic, that this was somebody who the local bishop was willing to share a stage with. And I think for some Catholics in Ohio, that may have made a difference. But there is one Catholic politician this year who did kind of buck the trend as well by doing almost the only faith outreach that happened among Democrats. And that's Tom Perriello in Virginia, who ended up losing. But he was one of the few Democratic candidates who really kept talking about his faith the whole time and kept putting issues like the economy and losing jobs into kind of social justice language and using that in terms of his outreach. And although he ended up losing his seat, he came much closer than other Democrats who maybe won those seats in 2006 and 2008 that Democrats were never going to hold on to because they weren't really naturally their seats. And some of that's because he just was willing to stand on principle where other people weren't. But I think part of that principle is driven by his faith and his just insistence on being authentic about his faith instead of just pulling it out when it seems like a campaign were to work.
Well, I'm going to disagree with you there. So certainly, I mean, we already talked about it. He's not the only Democrat who did this. Jack Conway did it in Kentucky with a really ugly fashion
way.
And lost. Brad Ellsworth did it in Indiana and a kind of respectable conservative Catholic Democratic.
Right, but outreach is
and
not
he
just
also
talking
lost.
About faith.
Sorry?
Oh, outreach is not just talking about.
I think those guys were campaigning in churches. I mean, there's a lot of Democrats who are campaigning in churches. And
well, they always go to black churches, but that's not the type of outreach that was being done in 2006 and 2008, which started to lead to larger pickups.
Exactly, but nonetheless, people were doing this kind of rhetoric. And I think, you know, one of the things that you see happening is you keep on... You just used a word authentic, and it was a word that I picked out. I'm going to quote it from Eric Sapp, because he's one of the consultants who's been talking a lot about this in his article about it. He says, Democrats did faith work, I'm quoting, Democrats did faith work differently than the Republicans had in the past, focusing on authenticity of narrative and humility and how they brought faith into the public square. Now, you know me, I'm a pretty liberal guy, but that almost makes me want to vote for a Republican because that's so smug. Oh, see, the difference between our faith outreach and Republican outreaches is ours was real and humble. Well, you know, Republicans feel that theirs is real and humble too. And I think what that's sort of ignoring is that they're kind of, it didn't, you know, you talked about leveling the playing field, but what's happened with Democrats and faith outreach is that they haven't leveled the playing field. They've just gone over onto the Republicans' playing field, and they're doing it in Republican terms. And they're doing it and saying, you know, the implicit message that's played out again and again is vote for me because I'm a Christian. That's really what a lot of these guys ended up doing. They're not going to say it quite that plainly. Jack Conway kind of did.
But again, that kind of outreach doesn't work. And that's not what happened in 2006.
Well, it does. It works for Republicans, you know, in case.
Because that's their constituency. Because it doesn't necessarily work in vote for me, I'm a Christian. It works in you can't vote for that other guy. He's not a Christian. He's not a real Christian.
Oh, that's a good
distinction,
yeah.
And I think that there is a difference there. And again, somebody like Perriello isn't out there trying to win by suggesting that his opponent isn't a real Christian.
He absolutely is, and I admire that guy. I'm sorry that he lost. But he absolutely is, and I think that's you have to recognize that what feels authentic and humble to you, if you're on the other, you know, that statement of the authenticity and humility of the Democratic narrative is only because the Republican narrative doesn't seem authentic and humble to Democrats. But it's expressed like that. You know, a lot of those Republicans who are out there, you know, I think of some of the guys I've really talked to a lot or studied, you know, guys like Senator Tom Coburn or Sam Brownback, who's moved up to the governor of Kansas and so on. They really feel that it's authentic. They feel like they're just talking about something personal. They feel like they're not trying to challenge another person's faith. But that's the thing. And if the other person doesn't want to talk about their faith background, whether because it's personal or because maybe it's not going to, you know, it's not something widely shared or something like that. If you just say, you know, I'm not going to talk about the other guy. I'm just going to talk about my humble love of God. Well, what's that left for the other person to do? And that's what I say, that they've gone over onto the Republican praying field. You know, there is no kind of really small D democratic way to do that. You're saying, I think one of the criteria here should be your relationship with God, and in particular with a Christian God.
Well, we should probably move on to another topic, but I will say, you know, we do agree on the fact that Republicans can absolutely be authentic about this. They can also be very crass in terms of knowing that there are constituencies they can turn out easily. Democrats can do exactly the same thing. But I think for me, the difference in terms of how you and I see this is that just for decades, it was something Democrats were very hesitant to talk about. A, because they thought that it was inappropriate for them to speak about that part of who they are. John Kerry used to say, you know, I'm a Democrat and I'm a U.S. Senator, and the two things aren't related. And that's simply not how people of faith think about their faith. It's not something they check at the door.
People of faith, that's not how people of faith think about their faith. We've got about 85% of America lives in God. What do you mean how people of faith think about faith? And this is what bothers me about the Democratic outreach to people of faith. It's really crushing this wild, beautiful kind of bizarre tapestry, the varieties of religious experience in America into, you know, people of faith, POF.
Well, Jeff, you know very well, I was just using that as shorthand to try to get into another point that didn't have to do with
I don't think we can use it as shorthand. I mean, I think that's something we really got to focus on. I think that's
all right. Well, Carrie said that because some Muslims and some Jews and some Methodists and some Lutherans and some Sikhs and some Buddhists don't separate out their beliefs in terms of who they are as religious people from the rest of their identity. And so that is one of the things that they see as kind of false when somebody tells them that their religious identity has nothing to do with who they are in the rest of their lives. That's just something that automatically kind of rings a bell for them or raises a red flag that this person is probably faking their faith when they talk about it because it seems like that's not true. But
well,
I think we're both pushing each other
into defending things we wouldn't want to defend. I've pushed you into defending people of faith, and now you're pushing me into defending John Kerry, which I really don't want to defend. You're right, absolutely. That kind of statement is ridiculous and absurd. But let's take it, you know, let's take it to Oklahoma, where people of faith of all sorts responded to a narrative that they felt was authentic. But it's probably pretty troubling to most, which was that the people of Oklahoma voted, I think, by 70% to 30% to outlaw the use of Sharia law in court decisions. Because, you know, Oklahoma judges were just going crazy imposing Sharia law. So someone just drew a line in the sand and said it had to stop. And that someone, by the way, I mean, this had some pretty prominent support. James Woolsey, former director of the CIA, really came out swinging on this issue and supporting them and talking about the danger of Sharia law taking over America. Since that happened, a judge has already put a block on the implement of this piece of referendum. But, you know, the issue has been introduced. You know, what would seem like a kind of a fringe idea has now become state law in one state. And the question is this an aberration or do we think that this might have legs?
Yeah, well, it is troubling, and even the, you know, discussing the fact of a judge putting a block on it, implies that, you know, this was actually a problem, and so now people can continue going on using Sharia law.
right.
You know, as we know, that just doesn't happen, not just in Oklahoma courtrooms, but you really can't find anywhere in any courtroom in America where this has even begun to be an issue. It was something that Sharon Engel raised as well in her Senate campaign, which we will just note didn't work out all that well for her. And it was really interesting to me to see she had singled out Dearborn, Michigan, which is close to my hometown, as one of the places in the U.S. where this is in danger of completely taking over. As we know, Dearborn is where the largest population of Arabs in the U.S. lives. And the mayor of Dearborn wrote her an open letter, kind of really harshly taking her to task and saying, for one thing, it's ignorant to refer to Arabs as all Muslims. Dearborn has a huge population of Chaldean Christians and is a very diverse community. But secondly, Arabs have been in Dearborn for about 100 years now. Henry Ford really courted them as chief workers for some of his first plants in the Detroit area. And so if they're trying to take over with Sharia law, they're doing a really poor job of it because it's been 100 years. It hasn't really taken yet.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, the other interesting thing about this is the sort of the kind of solidification of Sharia law as something that we have to worry about. And what's interesting to me about this is sort of the mainstream is when you have that extreme statements like Sharon Engel or the Oklahoma law, that puts, I would argue that we're both a little saner than that, that puts sane people like us in the position of saying, well, Sharia law isn't even close to happening. And there's a little kind of strange little victory that happens for bigotry there, because when we say, well, Sharia law is not even close to happening, we're almost sort of agreeing with their terms that Sharia law is this kind of horrific, barbaric thing that one wouldn't want to happen, but it isn't happening anyway. when, you know, the reality is Sharia law, first of all, it's commonly misrepresented, not just by Sharon Angle, but by mainstream media organizations. It's not Islamic law.
Right.
This is not what the Quran says. Sharia law is very specifically, it's the most sort of living document of law you can find. It's the human attempt to interpret God's will. Now, that's not appropriate in a democracy with separation of church or mosque and state, but nonetheless, it's not this fixed, rigid thing that it's been represented as. And some more traditionally matriarchal Muslim societies, you see Sharia law with much more equitable divisions of gender between men and women. I mean, it's a changing body of law. Now, I'm not saying that why don't bring it on? I'm saying that the rhetorical moves of the right are dragging the whole conversation into this bigoted place, where it's hard for us to even separate ourselves out from their hate speech.
Yeah, you're right, and it is dangerous because it would be, as you said, more appropriate for us to say that religiously based laws are not in place in America, and to point out that in fact there are groups of conservative Christians who wish they were, who they would argue that U.S. law should be based on Christian principles. And in fact,
and a lot of them won election.
Yes,
a couple weeks ago. So yeah,
and they would argue, well, they think we're a Christian country, so that would be appropriate. But because we're not a majority Muslim country, the Sharia law wouldn't be appropriate. But you're right that it's kind of a dangerous ground that it gets us into. And I wonder if this is similar to the Juan Williams statement of a few weeks back, just in terms of the very broad way in which people are comfortable not only talking about Muslims as one type that we should be afraid of, but also conflating all sorts of religious expression with some sort of dangerous political idea.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's an interesting point, and maybe that gives us a segue to another subject. I know we were going to talk about Glenn Beck, but that conflation of religion with political idea, we had on our list of things we wanted to talk about today, some news coming out of the U.S. Air Force Academy. Mm-hmm. And it reminded me that I spent some time out there a few years ago researching sort of what's going on with religious politics in the military for my book, Sea Street. And what amazed me was that across the political spectrum and across the religious spectrum of cadets there, I kept on encountering this idea that Islam is not actually a religious idea. It's a political idea. And this wasn't just coming from, you know, anti-Muslim Christian fundamentalists. This was coming from the liberal cadets who said, well, but Islam, we've been taught, is not actually a religious system. It's a political system. And you see that idea kind of moving around on the conservative side of things. And so you see why they see, you know, well, the comparison of Sharia law and it's, is not relevant to our idea that this is a Christian nation. The more apt comparison of Sharia law would be to communism, a political system, an ideological system. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, that goes beyond sort of bigotry, but into sort of a whole paradigm shift of how we talk about people who might believe other than us.
Mm-hmm. Well, where did that come from? Because we've also heard that this year raised in terms of the suggestion that Muslims don't deserve protection under the First Amendment.
That's right. Who was that? The Lieutenant Governor of Tennessee. And you had on a list of things we should talk about too, a mosque issue in Tennessee. Will you tell us more about that?
Yeah, well, it's very similar to what you just said. They've been holding a hearing because this mosque, and I'm going to get this wrong, but I think it's Murfreesboro, Tennessee.
Oh, I think you're right. Yeah, that's it.
They had been granted an okay by the city council, I believe, to build a mosque. And so some angry citizens have, I guess, appealed that decision. And so there's this kind of trial of a sort taking place right now. And one of the arguments is that this isn't a legitimate religion. But mostly the trial appears to be a way to just throw out a whole heck of a lot of anti-Muslim rumors and stereotypes and conspiracies And the guy who's running it is not putting a lid on that at all. So it's certainly not something where the emotions had died down, but this is stirring them up even further than they had been before. And considering that it seems like the building of the mosque is going to continue, that's just not good news in terms of what the community fever is going to be like. Which isn't at all a reason not to build it, just seems inappropriate in terms of public officials who maybe should be looking for a way to tamp down the emotions instead of whipping them up.
Well, yeah, speaking of, you know, the fever rising, so let's bring it back then to Glenn
Beck. The Air Force.
Now we're on the fever. Now the fever is rising. We're reaching the boiling point. And I feel like we've got the segue here because the question always becomes – and this is the question that we're, you know, you and I are discussing, people are discussing for a long time, you know, are we reaching this boiling point in American politics? And, you know, one of the, where we have things, you know, we have bigotry passing over from fringe into, you know, law in places like Oklahoma or mainstream candidacies, as Sharon Angle's candidacy did become, or certainly, you know, a state like Tennessee, just feeling like it's fine to go ahead with this kind of, you know, there's no pressure from the state to saying, hey, you know, we've got to protect all our citizens here. And are we reaching a boiling point? And I'm with Glenn Beck, I'm referring to, this is, you know, I had actually missed this and you drew my attention to it. I'm just looking at my notes here on that. Glenn Beck did a two-part series on George Soros, the billionaire financier who funds a lot of liberal causes, the Open Society Institute. The series was called The Puppet Master. And it begins with a sort of, it begins with footage. It looks like, you know, Goebbels shot it. Yeah. George Soros' face in grainy black and white and old-timey kind of 1930s film stock of a puppet's drawstrings being pulled. The Puppet Master, George Soros, who he describes as Jewish, but he's not Jewish enough for Glenn Beck. He's not the right kind of Jew. He was a Jew, but now he's an atheist. Glenn Beck does not seem to understand that you're Jewish, whether or not
culturally,
you go to shul. But that more importantly, that he's a he's a puppet master who controls banking, who destroys economies, has destroyed economies all over the world. Next is us, and really kind of invokes every cliche of classic anti-Semitism. And, you know, let me just give us one quote, maybe we can talk about it. This comes from J.J. Goldberg, who's a longtime editor of the Forward, the Jewish Forward. And J.J. Goldberg is really one of the most reliable and perceptive observers of Jewish political life in America. Very, very fair-minded, very, very balanced. He says, there's a difference between first-degree murder and vehicular homicide, which is intentionality. He says he's not convinced that Beck meant to attack the Jews. Nevertheless, he described the show as close as I've heard to mainstream television to fascism. This is not a guy who is, you know, prone to using that language. And is this a boiling point? Do we set the stage with these midterm elections for a boiling point, or is this just a simmer?
You know, it's a really good question, and it's something I've been thinking about a lot because, you know, we're always reminded of how short our memories are. And so I've been, you know, thinking and reading about the know-nothings going after Catholics and, you know, how in 1960 people were trying to convince themselves and others that if Kennedy were elected, that, you know, similar to the Sharia concern, that we would somehow be under Catholic law, that the Pope would be directing the president and approving all decisions. So this is not new, but there is something new about it. And I guess I'm trying to figure out the previous levels of fear and demagoguery simmered down at some point. But is that possible to happen with the type of media that we have now? I just don't know. It's really.
I think you really put your finger on it right there. Do we have the institutional framework to cool it down?
Hmm. Well, we probably do have the institutional framework to cool it down. The question is, can it happen? You know, one of the things that was disturbing I found in the debate over the Park 51 Center, which was called the Ground Zero Mosque, which we seem to have moved on from very quickly. It probably served its purpose of scaring people, and now we can go on to the next thing, was how quickly mainstream Democrats felt the need to weigh in and assure people that they in no way were on the side of scary Muslims. And, you know, unless you have people who stand to lose something, who are willing to stand up and actually be the voice of sanity and reason, it's going to be very hard to use the infrastructure that could push back against other voices within the media and within the political sphere to try to simmer things down. I mean, we have the means to do it. What we need are the people who are willing to push back, and we haven't seen a lot of that.
Yeah, yeah. I don't. I guess I would question whether we have the means to do it. Even. I mean, leaving aside the know nothings, which is really far back, but just the Kennedy moment, the Kennedy debate, we still had a very consensus-driven media then, and I'm glad to see that gone. I'm one of these people who likes all this sort of these ridiculous little fragmentation of media. I think that's great. I think that brings us back to, you know, the early sort of Republican, small r Republican model of the press in American life, you know, way back in the early days. But, you know, there's no Walter Cronkite to come in and put the kibosh on this language. And so that's fine. Then it's up to us. It's up to us as sort of a small D Democratic crowd. And I don't see that happening. So I think what, you know, I think you're right to point out that it's you got to be very wary about saying, you know, is this a boiling point? We've got to remember history. And that's something you and I have talked a lot about, is that, you know, most of these things that people get afraid of, in fact, have happened many times before in American life. But something does feel new about this hate, which is it's just got a more, maybe a more liquid form. Maybe it's a little more agile. It's a little less rooted in a pre-existing constituency. It's a newly forming hate rather than an old hate coming up. And I think that, you know, just that language, that saying that Islam is a religion, is an ideology, not a religion. Mm-hmm. That's kind of an interesting, that's an interesting move. That's not coming out of a, you know, well, my grandpappy taught me that Islam is a, is an ideology, not a religion. That's innovation. That's hate coming up as a new thing, as an innovative thing. Mm-hmm.
And it's frankly being willing to believe an email you get from maybe somebody you know, but originally written by a complete stranger, over maybe even your instincts.
Yeah, yeah, and I think, you know, it's the thing though that we tend to make fun of people who believe emails that they get from strangers, but we forget that, you know, the transmission of information and knowledge usually takes place in such a fashion that by the time it mm-hmm. reaches us, it doesn't actually feel like a stranger. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know. You take an example of what's her name, Pamela Geller.
Yes.
You know, the prominent anti-Islamic activist, and you know, people they think they know her. She's able to create a real intimacy with her media. I mean, you know, real intimacy. You know, remember her first anti-Muslim screeds were filmed with her sort of bobbing in the water in a bikini. So you sort of think, well, this is a here's Pamela, my friend, or if you're an ogler, here's Pamela, this, you know, this hot chick who's saying all the same hateful things that I feel. How awesome is that? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's not that people are being duped by they're being more willing to believe strangers. It's that we have fewer strangers. That is maybe what sort of I feel like is sort of the breakdown in the institutional framework. And that seems like a good thing, is that that we can sort of talk to each other, not as strangers, but in this more intimate, direct way. But I think we're going to have to develop new approaches to fighting back against these bigotries, because there is no Big Daddy Cronkite to come in and put a stop to it anymore, and there shouldn't be.
Right. Well, you know, maybe to give us a hopeful note to close on, you know, if we're in a world of fragmentation, which it seems like we are, and there's no going back from it, whether you like it or not, it does kind of raise the importance of what has always been the closest influence to people, which is their immediate community. And I know in Michigan, there's been a lot of work in terms of interfaith dialogue, and some of the outcome of that has been some pastors who might not otherwise have made this an interest of theirs at all, in getting to meet Muslim leaders and then returning to their own churches. And these are folks who may be getting these emails, but if their pastor is initiating conversations with them and being willing to talk about Muslims as people who are religious believers in their own right, even if they believe something else, that's the kind of more positive conversation that could take place. Now, it requires pastors and other religious leaders to themselves believe that Muslims are not all terrorists who are looking for any excuse to turn around and kill you. But because I think there are more rational religious leaders than not, although I know people can always argue with that, it seems like that might be a possible way to have conversations within communities that maybe aren't taking place yet. Yeah. And wouldn't be in the public school, which is, I think, where people's instinct is to jump to, well, we'll just teach tolerance through the public school, and we'll teach everybody that Muslims are good people. You know, that's all well and good, but that gets people all riled up in issues about public education.
And it doesn't work very well, because you're trying to teach. I mean, schools are, look, you know, I've got a little daughter, and so do you, and they're going to go off to school. Schools are necessarily authoritarian structures. You do what the teacher says.
Yeah.
Teacher might give you some leeway. And these conversations have to happen in a more free-willing space,
yeah,
a space where bigots are going to feel free to express their bigotry and have that engaged. And so right. that's not a thing for a school. We can't force that off on our kids. That's a conversation that adults need to have.
Right. You're absolutely right.
Well, there's a happy note. We worked our way around to a happy note to end
Excellent.
On. It's great talking to you as always, Amy, and congratulations again on the newborn.
Thank you. I hear the poor little girl screaming downstairs with her Abba, so I think I need to go rescue him. But this has been a pleasure, and it's been especially good to talk about something other than Dr. Seuss for an hour. So thank you, Jeff. Let's do this again.
Take care, Amy. Bye-bye.
Okay, you too.